Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens, at the heart of Irish homes for over 40 years. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb@rte.ie.
We all spend about 8 hours doing it every day, but what happens when we don't? Is an hour missing from our sleep schedule really going to impact the state, our state of mind? We know sleep is really important for a healthy lifestyle, but is it just as important to our mental health and even our general cognitive ability? Well, to tell us just how important sleep is, I'm joined by Professor Andrew Coogan, who is behavioural neuroscientist and director of the Chronobiology and Sleep Research Laboratory at Maynooth University. Lovely to have you back. Back with us, Andrew, and lots of questions have been coming in on 51551. The 8 hours, can we just address that first? Is that a myth, or is it around about the right amount of sleep for everybody?
For the average person, it's between 7 and 8 hours for an adult, but of course, who's average? And it varies quite widely between people. So actually, the message we prefer now is to personalise your sleep. So that might mean 8 hours is the right amount for you. It might mean 6 hours is the right amount for you. It might mean 9 hours a night is what you need. Mm-hmm. So if you I think I like to express it as, if you think you don't have a problem, then you probably don't have a problem. So but not to feel that oppressive.
Exactly. Don't do that self-fulfilling thing where you wake up and you think, I've only had 6 hours, so I'm going to have a terrible day. You may not have a terrible day.
Yeah, and there's lots of people out there for whom 6 hours, 7 hours, 6.5 hours, that's absolutely fine. That's the way they're built. Some people are tall, some people are short. It's a bit like that with our sleep.
Okay, but it is important to get the right amount of sleep for you.
For you, yeah.
Okay, because if you don't, you'll run into all sorts of problems.
Yeah, so we like to think of sleep as one of the key pillars of health, with exercise and diet. And by that, we mean both physical health and mental health. And we're probably with sleep now where we were with exercise and diet maybe 20 years ago. Now, you know, you go to your GP and you always talk about what are you eating? Do you exercise? Go 20 years ago, you probably wouldn't have had those conversations. So we're lagging a little bit behind, but the realisation is coming now. This is a key thing. And it's something that we can modify. I think that's really important. There's a part of it that is within our control and that we can get benefits from modifying our sleep for the better.
Mm-hmm. And people who can't sleep are listening to that now going, I can't modify my sleep. But are you telling them that in most cases you can?
So I think there are two distinctions. There's an important distinction here. I think there's people, we can all do better probably with our sleep, but there is a significant group of people out there in the population, and we know they're out there, who have a sleep disorder, who have something like chronic insomnia or sleep apnea. And for those people, they really need help and guidance to a healthcare professional, mm-hmm. because you're not going to tweak your way out. You're not going to sleep hack your way out of a sleep disorder. So if you have an ongoing issue, for example, with insomnia, we talk about most nights of the week for at least a month or more. So obviously we all have bad nights. That's normal. But if it's an ongoing issue, then you really probably need to engage with healthcare professionals.
Okay, so in the first instance, that would be your GP. But where would you be looking towards next? Who helps you with sleep disorder?
So this is a big problem I think we have in general in sleep medicine. We know what works. So for example, a type of psychotherapy for insomnia called cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. Loads of evidence this is really effective. Clinical guidelines, first line treatment. Big problem is, there's just not enough therapists out there to deliver it. Mm-hmm. So there are some really good validated internet-delivered or app-delivered programs based on this, really scientifically validated. Unfortunately, they're commercial. They're not available on the health system. But that's a big problem. So we know what works. And it's very frustrating when you have to say to people, look, I know what could possibly help you, but it's just, that help isn't there.
So just interesting what you say about those. The sleep apps, you're saying some of them work, do they?
No, there's specific, I'm not talking about your activity tracker or stuff like that.
Yeah.
I'm talking about bespoke. So for example, there's one called Sleepio, which is actually prescribed on the NHS for the treatment of insomnia disorder. And it's completely scientifically validated. I have no connection or anything.
Yeah.
But it's based on the same type of program you would get if you had a therapist, but delivered through an app.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a 6-week program. And it can help. Now, it's not going to help everyone, but we know treatments don't help everyone. Unfortunately, as I said, these are commercial applications.
Right.
So there is a subscription fee. They're not terribly onerous, but in the absence of other supports.
It might be worth trying. That's called Sleepio.
Yeah.
So is that talking you through falling asleep, or is it doing
something
else?
So there's two main components of cognitive behavioural. It's cognitive behavioural therapy. So cognitive deals with our thoughts and our beliefs. So often people who have bad sleep have what we term maladaptive or unhelpful beliefs and thoughts about their sleep. So they might catastrophise, oh my God, I'm not sleeping, I'm going to be wrecked tomorrow, my life's going to be a mess. So it helps reset our patterns of thinking about sleep. People who don't sleep well tend to see sleep as a threat. So there's nearly like a stress reaction. Oh, mm-hmm. my God, because it's horrible. You know, it's horrible lying in bed, staring at the ceiling, not being able to sleep. So the cognitive part of that tries to reset those thoughts from the unhelpful to the helpful. The behavioural bit then tweaks our behaviours. So wind down in the run-up to sleep, diet, exercise, maybe avoiding caffeine, maybe cutting down on alcohol. All these behavioural things that we know can also help. So putting them both together can really help us address some types of sleep problems. Not all types of sleep problems, but certainly something like insomnia disorder.
Mm-hmm. And for some people, the minute their head hits the pillow, they start worrying about things.
Yeah.
And they start worrying about things that they mightn't have given 2 seconds thought to for the whole entire day. So not big problems, little things that are coming in 4 weeks' time.
Yeah.
Why does that happen?
So that's something we call rumination. And we know that's a really important cognitive factor in insomnia. So when you're churning those problems over in your mind. So one useful bit of advice is just if you find yourself doing that in the hour or two before bedtime, just make a list, write 5-10 things down that are worrying you, saying, look, I'm going to park them there. I'll deal with them tomorrow. I'm going to wake up in the morning, look at my list, and I'll deal with them in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And often actually having a decent night's sleep helps us deal with our problems. You know, we all know, you know, the old maxim about sleep and a problem. Actually, there's loads of scientific evidence that suggests that actually is true, that
works.
We help sort of get the solution to problems during the night as our sort of brain is churning over and ticking over as we sleep.
Mm-hmm. Now, we have lots of questions. We always do when you come in. This one from Therese, who says she goes to bed at 10:30, reads for 30 minutes, falls asleep straight away, no problem.
Yeah.
Wakes after 4 hours and can't get back to sleep no matter how hard I try. Now, she gets up, goes downstairs, read or do some ironing. She can stay going, though, and never feels tired. And it happens 2 or 3 nights a week.
Yeah. So that sounds like, if it's happening ongoing, that's something probably sounds like what we term sleep maintenance insomnia. So that is a manifestation of insomnia. We can get asleep, but after that sort of 3-4 hours that we're awake and we're wide awake.
Mm-hmm.
And again, if that's ongoing most days a week for a month or more, then that's probably is indicative of an ongoing issue. And I would encourage your listener maybe to check in with their GP as a first line, because sometimes sleep problems are linked with other physical health issues or mental health issues. They don't have to be. They can occur on their own. They can cause mental health issues as well. You know, if you're not sleeping, it can make us more prone to anxiety, depression, other things that we, you know, certainly don't want to have. But I think that sounds like a classic description of sleep maintenance insomnia.
But most people will wake up, will they, in the night? And
we actually wake up loads in the night and we don't even know we're waking up.
Right.
And lots of people wake up and fall back asleep. It's one of the things we look at in our studies. We call it wakenings after sleep onset. And that's sort of pretty normal. But the waking when you're sort of fully awake, mm-hmm. you know, and it's like light on, and then you look at the clock and it's 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. Did you see that research recently which said that looking at a screen actually isn't that bad for you, the blue light from the phone or the iPad?
Yeah, I think the jury's really out on that. The amount of light that might be coming off an iPad or a phone may not really be that biologically significant. Actually, one of the things we know is that we're actually quite different. Some people are super sensitive to light. Some people are a lot less sensitive to light. So it probably varies mm-hmm. according to who you are. It probably is more important if you're just the general arousal, you're looking at a screen, you're sort of getting into whatever you're looking at. You're looking at your email. Now you're annoyed because, you know, you've got a, you know, no, you know what I mean?
Mary from accounts has sent you an email and you've read it and that's going to keep
exactly,
you
awake. Exactly. Yeah. And now you're doing what you would be doing during the day, but you're doing it at night mm-hmm. and you want to really avoid that. So I think those aspects of using screens at night are probably a lot more important than any light that comes off them.
Okay. Now, here's another question. My dad is 88, finding mm-hmm. it hard to sleep at night. They've tried sleeping tablets for a short while. They worked well, but he's now on 2 tablets of melatonin, a very low dosage, 2 milligrams each. But they're not really helping. So this person checked with the pharmacist. She advised that the dosage needs to be increased. But what would you recommend for someone who is at that age of 88? He'd love to get a good night's sleep.
Yeah. So unfortunately, like many things, we know that sleep tends to get worse as we get older. 88 is an absolutely great age. Melatonin can be very helpful. But melatonin is a hormone. You know, I don't think we'd expect to go down the supplement shop and buy, you know, gummies with testosterone or estrogen in it. So I think, and melatonin can be helpful, but has to be used under the appropriate clinical guidelines and guidance. Mm-hmm. It also can interact with some other medications. So it is actually really important that a healthcare professional actually oversees that. It can work for people. There are different formulations of it, different types. Sometimes they sort of release it across the night. And for some people, unfortunately, sleep does decline with age quite a bit.
Which is fine if it doesn't bother you. But if it does bother you, which it sounds like it is in this case, you're wondering what to do and you'd really like to fix it.
Yeah. And again, the issue with sleeping tablets is that they're generally not recommended for long-term usage. But there may be circumstances where they can help you sort of burst the bubble, if you like, and get into a sort of better rhythm. And then you can sort of taper off them once you've sort of re-established some good sleep behaviours.
But not for long-term
Generally not for long-term, because there's concerns about addiction potential and the like for those medications.
A listener who's just texted us to say they have a radio on all night, and if they don't have the radio on, they can't sleep.
Yeah.
It's news stations. Now, is that good? Is that good
news?
Yeah,
there's some evidence, like you can have these sort of white noise generators, and it probably is at that level. So it's just like a background hum, nearly. It's, you know, it could be your washing machine or whatever. Mm-hmm. And there is some evidence that it can be helpful, particularly if you're really sensitive. You know, lots of people who don't sleep great are really sort of tuned in to detect any annoyances in their sleep environment. So if you live in somewhere that, you know, you're going to hear a noise at night and that's going to annoy you and sort of make it less likely you go to sleep. Having that sort of background drone, and I don't want to imply the radio is droning, but that can actually help her sort of tune it out. So there is some evidence. And again, if it works, go with it.
Yeah.
You know, if it works for you, super.
Maria would like to know if magnesium supplements are helpful for sleep.
Yeah, there's some suggestion that magnesium supplements might be helpful. Like a lot of stuff, the stuff on the internet out about this, like a lot of this stuff, there is some scientific evidence, probably not to the point where you'd want to nail your colours to the mast either way. Mm-hmm. I'm a bit skeptical, right, in honest.
We have a lot of people wondering if naps are a good idea.
Yeah. So this is a classic question. In general, I think if you nap during the day and you don't have a problem sleeping at night, getting to sleep at night or staying asleep at night, then that's probably fine. Try to limit your naps to about 20 minutes.
Oh, that's impossible. Like, if you want to have a nap, you want to have more than 20 minutes.
Well,
right?
The problem with having a longer nap is then you wake up with that sort of horrible fuzzy feeling, what we term sleep inertia. And actually, the evidence is that you get as much benefit from the 20-minute nap as the hour nap. If you do nap during the day and you're having problems getting to sleep at night, probably try to cut down on the nap, because we want to increase the sleep pressure. So make it more likely that when you do go to bed in the evening, that you do fall asleep. And that likelihood increases the tireder we are.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there, Andrew, for now, but we could keep going. So we will have you back to answer more of those questions that have been coming in. That's Professor Andrew Coogan.